My name is Paul Bolf. We've been talking about some kinds of interpersonal and interracial relationships, talking about Native American people or Indian people. And on Wednesday, we had a session on racism. Tonight, I approach the subject with a certain amount of fear and trembling because none of us have had much of any experience with this. And so I'm talking about a subject about which I have had almost no particular experience, except experience in other contexts. The subject tonight is inclusiveness in the new Lutheran Church. Now, some of you may not be Lutherans, and if you're not interested in listening to a discussion of inclusiveness in the new Lutheran Church, why, this is a time to get up and leave. But it may well be that what we're going to say about this new Lutheran Church might apply just as well across the board to almost any church, or it might even apply to non-church organizations. I think as we look at the at inclusiveness, I think that applies across the board, and more in our country we're going to have to contend with that kind of a concern. I was in the New American Lutheran Church in 1960. I was one of the first new executives of the New American Lutheran Church, which included the former ALC, which was of German background, and the former UELC, which was of Danish background, and the former ELC, which was of mostly Norwegian or Scandinavian background. And at that time, in 1960, I didn't ever hear the word inclusiveness even mentioned. I don't think it was even a concern. I didn't hear anyone talking about including women on boards. And in fact, except for the board of what was called ALCW at that time, American Lutheran Church Women, I don't remember that there was a single woman on any board of the new ALC in 1960. I don't remember any people of color on any of our boards in the ALC in 1960. There might have been, but I'm not aware of them. A few women came, pardon?
Trout,
was he? Who?
Reverend Trout?
No, he was not on any of the boards or anything at that time. He was, I think, Pastor Trout was, very early on, he came into the Department of Evangelism as an evangelist. But I don't think that any of the board, the policy-making board people at that time. I remember our board, the Board of Social Service, of which I was the director, a black woman from Durham, North Carolina, was elected to the Board of Social Service. And as I recall it, she was one of the very first people of color who were elected to any of the major boards of the American Lutheran Church in the early 1960. So the concept of inclusiveness, which means to include all manners of people, not only in the fellowship of the church, but in the structures and the power centers of the church, that in 1960 was not even considered, as far as I know. And I don't remember anyone raising his or her voice about the subject. I don't remember any women objecting that there weren't any women on the national boards of the church. I didn't hear any Indian people or any black people or any Hispanic people making any complaints about this. So apparently, this concern about the reaching out to all people and all people being included in the life and mission and operation of the church is something that's happened within the last 25 years. And I would say mostly within the last 10 or 15 years that we have become particularly conscious of that. And of course, inclusiveness reaches out in a great many ways. Dave Schroeder just handed me this green sheet I don't know how many of you have gotten this green sheet, which has to do with inclusive language at Holden. I have to tell you that my wife and I were here at Holden 2 years ago, and some of the staff people hadn't arrived on Sunday. We arrived on Saturday, and on Saturday afternoon, the person who was directing the program says, "Well, you'll have to preach tomorrow." Well, I wasn't prepared to preach or anything, and I had to scramble around and try to get a sermon cobbled together. And on Sunday, I preached a sermon. That is for the Eucharist on Sunday evening. And right afterward, a young man came up to me and he thrust this green sheet in my face and he said, "We don't use exclusive language at Holden. This is inclusive." And he handed this to me and I kind of reared back because I wasn't even aware that I had been using language that was offensive to someone who was concerned about inclusivity. And the only thing I could plead with him was that, "Well, I'm getting pretty old and it's difficult for me to change my ways." I don't think he thought very much of that. Well, three of the Lutheran church bodies, the LCA, the ALC, and the AELC, are now in the process of merging, as many of you already know, into a new church, which will be called the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, ELCA. We'd better get used to those initials. It's been a very complex process, and in some ways a very difficult and sometimes a controversial process. I live in northwest Wisconsin. We've had about a dozen congregations in northwest Wisconsin who have been very steamed up about the fact that the words inerrant, the word inerrant has been left out of the constitution of the new church as it refers to the Word of God. And no amount of explanation by theologians and others have been able to quiet the fears of some of our people there that somehow this new church isn't going to believe in the Word of God. I've had people come up and shake their finger under my nose and say, we're not going to believe in the Word of God anymore in this new church. And of course, that's absolutely far from the truth. But we have not moved into this new church without some pain and difficulty and adjustment. We've had to adjust to 60 new synods. One of the headlines in the St. Paul paper said, "New church elects 5 dozen new bishops." Sounded like going to the store and buying 5 dozen eggs, you know, or something. But that's going to be a real difficult kind of an adjustment to make. New geographic lines, new loyalties to different institutions and agencies. My part of Wisconsin always has supported Luther Northwestern Seminary in St. Paul. Suddenly we're going to be supporting the seminary in Dubuque and the one in Chicago, and many of our people have said, "Dubuque and Chicago? We didn't even know there was a seminary there." So this new church is being born with a great deal of anticipation, but also with a great deal of strain and a great deal of difficulty. One of the aspects of the new church that I'd like to discuss with you tonight and hear your questions and comments and opinion. One of the things that is going to be fascinating to watch and to participate in is the clause in the Constitution that says that this shall be an inclusive church. Not just that it will reach out to get members from all strata of society, males and females and colored people of color and white people and poor people and wealthy people and the like. That's not just it. What it's really saying is that all kinds of people shall be included in the centers of decision making, the centers of power, the centers out of which the life of the church flows. That all people, people of color, male and female, young and old, will be included. early on, when they began to think about inclusiveness in the new church, people thought, well, we're all Christians. Obviously, we're going to reach out and include all people. And then it began to dawn on those that were planning the new church that maybe just being Christians isn't going to be quite enough. After all, we've called ourselves Christians for a couple of hundred years in this country. And today, as the new church gets started, guess what? The new church is 97% white. 3%, maybe not even 3, maybe 2.5, nobody's quite sure, percent of the membership, as we move now into the new church in 1988, 97% is white. Well, boy, I can think of a dozen reasons why that's true. I can say my ancestors came from Norway, my grandfather came from Norway, he spoke Norwegian until he was in his middle age or older. He didn't get a chance to reach out to any people of color or anything like that. We can come up with lots of reasons. I'm sure most of you could come up with all kinds of reasons why our new church, with 5.5 million people in the United States, is still 97% white. So I guess the people that began to plan the new church came up with the thought, perished the thought, that being Christian, or calling ourselves Christian, isn't going to be quite enough to produce an inclusive church. So they built in what we call the quota system. The quota system. And the quota system says that within a certain period of time, hopefully not too long, all of the boards, all of the executive positions in the church, the bishops, and other persons who have to do with the mission and direction of the church, that there shall be a fair proportion of people of color, of youth, of women, and of all strata of our society. That is going to be an interesting thing to see happen. There are approximately 5.5 million members, or will be, in 1988. When this new church starts. A goal has been set by those who are planning the new church that by the year 2000, that's only going to be 12 years away, by the year 2000, the goal has been set that 10% of the new church will be people of color. That's a marvelous goal, but let's look at the reality. 5.5 million people. 10% of that is 550,000. In other words, if you just take 10% of the 5.5 million that are merging, not what it's going to be in 10 years. Hopefully that'll grow. But even at that, it's going to take 550,000 new people of color to achieve that goal of 10%. I did a little arithmetic a little while ago. 550,000 divided by 12 months in the year, comes up to 45,000 people per year. And if you want to boil that down per week, divided by 52, it comes out to about 800. In other words, if the goal of 10% of the new Lutheran church is going to be reached, it means that the church will have to attract You notice I didn't use the word include or bring in. It's going to have to attract 800 people of color per week. Wow. What a change that's going to be from our past history, which in a period of over 100 years has produced a church that is still 97% white. So I just lay this out for you to show you the magnitude of the goal that we in the church have set for ourselves. Yes?
For months I've been hearing about they made this decision. Who is they?
Well, we have to say they because up to this point, I don't think that there has been able to be a participatory kind of activity on the part of the broad membership of the church. We haven't had conventions of the new church, for example, until just this spring when we had synod convention. This spring we had the new constituting convention. That's had to spend most of its time on approving the constitution and all of the bylaws and the like. So the they includes persons who were selected early on, a number of years ago, to plan out this new church. First there was a commission of 70 representing a broad area of the church. Then there were transition teams of various kinds. Transition teams that had to do with program, transition teams that had to do with place, transition teams that had to do with new boundaries for units of the church, transition teams that had to do with mission, and so on. And so those transition teams have met. And then there have been transition teams at the synod, or the local level, 60 different local levels. But they've all been selected teams. They haven't been broad conventions of the church where you and I could voice our opinion.
When we went to
so
the convention,
in a sense, those of us who are ordinary members of the church have to say they, because there were a select group of people who have planned this out.
When we went to the Constituting Convention for the ELCAW, anyway, the new women's organization,
Okay. We
were just given this constitution
and
said, you can't change it, you have to accept it the way it is.
Okay. That's what I'm
talking
about.
So they did it, apparently.
That's what I'm talking about. No. That's what I mean by they. Who did you mean by they? You know, who set that up for the women? It must have
I don't know. They just simply came in and the officers told us, you have to accept it.
Okay. That sounds pretty grim. That really sounds pretty grim. But I don't consider it to be all that grim. Because if you've had anything to do with organizing new enterprises or new entities, you'll know that it just takes one awful lot of complex planning and study. Just the budget, for example, is such a complex thing, trying to put all of that budgetary stuff together, that it's very difficult. I trust the process. I trust that as this new church gets going and we begin to have our synod conventions, and we began to have our national conventions where the voices of the people can be heard, I feel that we're going to move along in mission. So I'm not afraid of that. But at this point, I'm sorry to have to say they. Somebody out there made those decisions.
It certainly was people from the church.
Oh, sure.
So we were all represented.
Yeah, well, whether we were represented or not.
Well, sure we were represented.
I mean, there were people from every area.
Right. You're right. But it was a small group of people. It had to be. It had to be that way.
But it still was the church.
Yeah. Okay. You're right. I'm glad you said that.
I know at least part of it was voted on at the convention last summer in Minneapolis, and the quota system was voted on.
Sure. A lot of stuff has fed into this, but as I said, I really don't care to get into a long-winded debate tonight about how the new church came into being and how its bylaws were written, because I'm not an expert on that, to tell you the honest truth. But I am interested in that particular clause which affects everybody. which says we're going to be an inclusive church. Now, constitution and bylaws of the new church have set up a quota system, as I mentioned, that there ought to be proportionate representation on the boards and in the executive positions and other positions of influence throughout the church after a certain period of time. I think about 10 years is about the goal for that. That means that within 10 years' time, for instance, since there are, I think, a few percentage points more women in the church than there are men, that if we really follow the quota system strictly, we ought to find within 10 years that there will be more than 50% of the bishops will be female. If we reach this 10% that I'm talking about here of people of color, it'll mean that 10% of the bishops will be people of color. Similarly with the boards of the new church, the policy-making board, similarly with the executives and the staff positions in the new church. The quota system is designed to assure that within a period of time, we will be indeed a representative church. Now, we haven't started out too well. As I said, we just elected 5 dozen bishops. Guess how many women were elected?
None.
None. Guess how many people of color were elected?
None.
No. One.
Two?
A Hispanic man who is elected the new bishop of the Puerto Rican Synod.
That's good.
So we have no women, and we have one person of color.
Terrific opportunities for advancement.
Pardon me?
Terrific opportunities for some progress.
Yes, I'm glad you see it that way. I'm not saying this to be cynical. I'm not saying this to be sarcastic. I love the church, and I'm very optimistic about the church. But I am saying it in order that as we enter this new church, we must do it with honesty and with realism. We must, if we hope to reach the goals that the church has set to include all people in all of the positions in the church which influence its mission, then I think we're going to have to look honestly at the task that lies before us, so that we can all pitch in to devise ways of meeting that task. I think it would be a very, very sad thing to come to the year 2000 and find that we were still only 3 or 4% people of color, or that we still had 100% of our bishops male and almost 100% of them white. That's the reality that all of us, I think, have to really take a look at. Now, I'd like to make several more comments and then open it up for some dialogue. What's this going to require? What is it going to require if we are to attract 550,000 people of color? Blacks, Indians, Hispanics, Asians, people in the Orientals, and the like. What is it going to take for us to be able to include, let's say, because inclusiveness is the word. There are some things I don't quite like about that, but I think we have to use that word because it's there. Well, my wife and I, Carola, my wife and I, have had a considerable experience over the last 20 years with Indian people. And one of the things that we have found almost universally, whether it's in Arizona or northern Wisconsin or out here in the West Coast and in the Pacific Northwest, or whether it's down in Oklahoma or Texas, wherever we've gone, We have found that there is a great deal of distrust between Indian people and the white church. Not just the Lutheran church, but all churches that are predominantly white. Distrust, which is based primarily on the fact that almost all of our churches have made magnificent policy statements. Statements which say, we are open to people of all races, colors, and so on. We are open to the poor. We are open to the outcasts, people who are oppressed or who are discriminated against, and so on. We have made some magnificent statements. I remember back in the 1960s when I was the national executive of the ALC. The ALC came out with a statement called Mission in a Time of National Crises, because we were going through all of the turmoil of the 1960s, you know, the race stuff and the Vietnam stuff and the feminism and the youth rebellion and so on and so on. And we were going through that, and we made this magnificent statement about a time of tension and difficulty and what the church was going to do. And the church pledged at that time to reach out to all people, to stand with the oppressed, to make the resources available, and so on and so on and so on. We didn't do it. We made steps and so on, but basically we didn't do it. And Indian people, as we know them, have been suspicious of all of these lovely statements about justice and support of the oppressed and so on, because we just have not backed them up with action. So one of the things that's going to be required, if we're going to change this to this, one of the things that's going to be required is integrity on the part of the church. Integrity. We will not see any influx of blacks and Indians and Hispanics unless this 97% white church can demonstrate that by its actions, what it does, not just what it says, but what it does, it's sincere about attempting to reach this goal of 800 people of color per week. To reach 550,000 or 10%. We don't have a great record in the past. We've made a lot of good statements, but we haven't had a great record of following them up. And one of the things we're going to have to do is to act with integrity. I don't know what we're going to do with integrity. That remains to be seen, and I think your question about who planned all this and so on is a good one. But I think by the time the processes of the church allow the people of the church to begin to express themselves, we'll begin to come up with some innovative ideas. And that's where you and I will have our input into the process. Second requirement, I think, is going to be openness. We're going to have to be open to people who are different from this 97% white church. We're going to have to be less rigid in our cultural attitudes, less rigid in our theological attitudes. We're going to have to be more willing, when these people look at us, to listen to them rather than to say to them, you come and join us on our terms. Here's the way our church is. You come and partake in our church. That's kind of the way we've done it in the past. We've set up our church, we've set up our policies, we have developed our cultural and theological attitudes, and then we have said to blacks and Indians and Hispanics and Asians and so on, come and join us. This is what we're like, but you're welcome to come in. But don't rearrange the furniture when you come in. You know, you sit in our straight back chairs and so on, but you know, don't sit on the floor or don't pull out the pillows and lie down on the floor, and so on and so on. We haven't been notable in the past about listening to the people whom we are trying to reach, to whom we are trying to reach out. That has not been one of our notable characteristics. I think I mentioned in an earlier session that I was in Denver a week and a half ago, for a four-day meeting of pastors who are serving congregations that are predominantly Indian, American Indian. All white, by the way. The pastors were all white, but they're serving Indian congregations. And the Indian theologian who was leading the session, and the woman from northern Minnesota, who's an Indian activist who was also helping to lead the session, said that if we expect Indian people to relate to this new church, we're going to have to listen to their spiritual history, their spiritual perception, some of the things that they come at religion with. And I think I mentioned the other day that he said, we Indians begin with creation. The most important religious stories we have among us are creation stories. And then we move into our relationship with God, having established that we are God's creation, the world around us is God's creation, we're a part of that great process of creation, and now we move into an understanding of God. He said, the trouble is you come at us with sin and grace. And he said, while Indians know what sin is, that kind of language just doesn't reach us. He said, if you're going to expect to reach Indians, you're going to have to listen to our spiritual perceptions and perhaps make some adjustments. Oh, that's going to be tough because we Lutherans aren't great on making adjustments. Especially theologically, you know, our theology has been pretty well cast in concrete, and you know, we still quote Martin Luther most of the time, and that's 400 and some years old now. So you know, we haven't really been notable for that. But I think that openness is going to have to be one of the characteristics. The third thing that I think is going to be important is that the church is going to have to be willing to stand with people of color, minority people, and people who are on the fringes of society, to stand with them in their struggle for equality, for justice, and for a piece of the action. We're going to have to stand with them in that. We're going to have to stand with them as they try to deal with racism. We're going to have to stand with them as they try to deal for justice and rights. We're going to have to stand with them as they attempt to make their values real in the new church. One of the things that Indian people I don't like to talk about myself in this, but I think this is one of the best illustrations I know. One of the things that has happened to Carol and me has been that Indian people have basically trusted us. And one of the reasons is that we have stood with them in some of the tough times. We have faced arrest. We have faced guns. And we have stood with some Indian people. I'm not saying that to brag. I'm just saying that that's a fact. And that has engendered trust. And unless the church at large is willing to do that, to put its resources, to put its support systems with and alongside of people who are struggling, colored people and the like, we are not going to win those people. So the willingness to stand with them in their struggle is going to be another requirement of the new church. A fourth requirement, I think, is going to be self-examination on the part of us who are 97% of the church, who are white. we're going to have to take a good long look at ourselves, a critical look. Maybe we might even be forced to look with repentance at times on some of the ways we have acted and some of the things we have done which have stood in the way of reaching up. And finally, fifth, I'm sure there are a lot more points, but for our discussion tonight, I think this is enough. A willingness to share power in the church. A willingness to share power. Earlier on, I said we're going to have 50% of the bishops are going to have to be women. 10% are going to have to be people of color. That's not easy because the people who are in power and the people who support them who are in power are not going to give that up very easily, especially if it means that we're going to have to change things by bringing in those kind of people. So I think a willingness to share power, to put women, people of color, people who are on the outside, on boards, in staff positions, as train them as pastors and leaders in the church. Okay, I think this has been enough to provoke probably some thoughts or some ideas or some questions. Let me conclude by saying that I look upon this new process with great enthusiasm. It's going to be a great adventure. I really, really just look forward to it. But I also am enough of a realist to know that it's not going to be an easy task.
Paul, from your own perspective, what would you say are the gospel roots of inclusiveness?
Well, I guess this isn't a direct scriptural quote that answers all of the questions, but one of the passages that has meant the most to me over the last 10 or 15 years has been the passage in Luke 4 where Jesus quotes Isaiah. Remember, he comes back to Nazareth and then he says, I'm come to open the eyes of the blind, to bring release to the captives, to open the doors of the prisons, and to bring liberty to the oppressed. When I was a young pastor, I preached a series of sermons on that when I was a young pastor back in Ames, Iowa, which was a lovely town and really neat. And I spiritualized that whole thing. I said that good news to the poor meant good news to people who are poor in spirit, humble. And when I said release to the captives, that meant release to people who are captive to sin. And when I said, when I read about opening the doors of the prisons, that meant those who are captive to evil influences and so on. And liberty to the oppressed meant freedom from guilt. And I spiritualized that whole thing, and it wasn't until much later in life when I got to be in the social work aspect of the church and really got to begin to work with people who were on the outside and were oppressed, that I began to realize that Jesus really meant what he said. The poor, the oppressed, the imprisoned, the captives. And there are millions of them around the world, and including ourselves at times. And I guess that, okay, if you want one thing that to me comes out of the gospel, it's that passage and all of the connotations that it has. In other words, Jesus didn't only come to be a spiritual, quote, spiritual savior. He came to deal with the totality of life, which means across the board for everybody.
The Great Commission in Matthew includes all people. Mm-hmm. That would be...
Yeah, go to all the world. Okay. We can. I think there could be all kinds of quotes from Scripture. Yeah?
I have a thought, and I don't know I don't even know how I feel on it, but when I was listening to, the, you know, like the determination that we seem to have to do this particular quota system, I just started thinking of like a comparison. And I almost see it like a group of deer in a forest. And they think, and they have, they feel the best worship system. And there's a couple rabbits and a frog that participate. But for the most part, the rest of the animals have their other things they're doing. And it's like these deer are determined that all of the animals need to fit into this particular lifestyle of worship.
Mm-hmm.
And so I almost see a sense of, have we asked all the blacks and the Indians and the other people out there if they really can fit into our particular, I mean, are we determined to do something that maybe we need to start from a different point of view rather than saying you come in and be an active working part of our community? Do we need to just start on a much simpler level, like, you know, becoming friends with and ministering to them whether they participate in our particular worship service?
Yeah, that's a very complex subject. But just to pick up on your one thought of worship there, we're going to move into the new church with the Lutheran Book of Worship, which has a very well-prescribed kind of liturgy. There are three different liturgies, but basically they're pretty much the same. And there isn't much flexibility there when you're talking about Indian people, for example. I mean, a lot of Indian people just aren't turned on by that. And when you get, like we had with Jack the other night, when he sang Negro spirituals and began to bring that kind of thing in, some of the Hispanic things that I've gotten, McCraw and I have gotten involved with in recent years, which really are different. I'm not against the LBW at all. I think it's great. It speaks to me, and I worship through it very well. But somewhere along the line, we're going to have to be open. I mentioned openness as one. If we're going to expect to reach out to people who are different, we're going to have to be open to some kinds of new expressions. And it's a question whether we can do that. Yeah.
There is a back door, though, and I take absolutely no credit for this. It was before my time in my church, but probably 8 to 10 years ago, some people in our church responded to the plight of the boat people and of the refugees, and I know probably there's others of you that have the same experience. But what happened there is that the result now is that we're one of the few congregations in our synod that won't have any trouble with any kind of quota system when we're asked to seat people of color on boards or in synodical conventions. And, you know, in some of our minds, there's been some question as to whether our Asian friends who attend our congregation do so because they feel we saved their lives and they owe us a lifetime of participation. But on the other hand, the pastors have a terrible task because they have to learn to pronounce all the names for the baptisms of the Laotians, the Cambodians, and the Vietnamese. And what's happened is that the families that we sponsored have brought in more and more and more and more and more Asian families until at practically every service there are several rows of Asian families. And it has meant, I think, that probably they sit there and they do fumble through the
sure.
LBW.
Yep.
And certainly there are some language barriers and things. But the church then responded by facilitating for an Asian language service. And that mixes some stuff that, you know, is certainly not necessarily kosher Lutheran. And also an Asian potluck happens, a fellowship happens, which a lot of the Caucasian families, white families, have become very involved with the Asian church members. And it's through those relationships, which are some of the primary original ones, where families said, you know, yes, we understand that you're living on an 8x8 square of plywood. You can come live at our house instead, and we'll try to help you get adjusted. And of course, it is a back door because there's a degree of that's easier than reaching out possibly to the black community. We had those folks kind of captive in that way, but you know, it's produced a church has a degree of inclusiveness for that group of Asian people.
Well, I'm sure that not everything is going to be done cleanly. You know, I mean, you talk about the back door. Sure, we're going to have a lot of kind of back doors. If we're going to reach this kind of thing, we're going to have to do it in many, many different ways.
But nonetheless, the first extension was not theological. It was simply
Yeah, we'd like to help.
Yeah, okay, that's very good. That's good. And that, by the way, there are a number of places that I'm aware of around the church where her story is true. And this, I hope, is the kind of experience we can build on. I think you had your hand up.
That any change can be very frightening. There's a fear of losing control. Mm-hmm. It's the unknown.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden.
Oh, sure.
There we are, our nice, comfortable white congregation. We know everybody. We know the routine. We don't have any language problems. You know, and all of a sudden you're talking about, you know, 800 people, and all of us are thinking 800 more people in our congregation.
Yeah.
You know, you apply it to your own congregation, you think that whole lot. And so there's going to be some real barriers against that happening.
Yeah.
But I was reminded of the passage that real love casts out fear.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we reach out not theologically. If we reach out theologically or to meet a quota, we're not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But if we really represent Christ talking to the woman, talking to the woman of Samaria yet, and loving her and showing her that he cared, then the quota will come along out of that.
Okay. I don't even have to add anything to that. That's great.
Yeah, I was just going to add to Carol's comment and kind of tie into your question of how are we going to, why is somebody going to want to join us? It isn't going to be because, you know, you're going to have such a lovely time here and you're going to have such a spiritual experience. It's going to be, you have been oppressed and to stand up with the blacks, with the civil rights and the Indians and the Hispanic and their need. And once you respond to their need, they'll see the love and wonder where that's coming from.
Yep.
And I think then you know, they're going to be feel that trust. And
yep.
So first, that's, the help's got to come first before the come join us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I meant when I said that we have to display some integrity, which comes out of what we do as well as what we say. And if we don't do that, I don't think we'll ever get over that, into that kind of gospel sort of thing that you're talking about.
What do you do if you don't have people that are colored in your community? Where do you get your quota?
That's a good question. That's a good question.
Yeah. Doctor from Vietnam.
Sure.
The church, the LCA asked him to come into our community.
Sure.
He stayed just long enough for us to build him a clinic, and then he didn't like a small town.
Okay.
Had promised this thing.
Yeah.
So
well,
it kind of turns you off.
I agree. And I think that I could only say two or three things to that. One is that if you are in a community where you do not have any people of color, for example, one of the things that you can do is to support those who are involved. When my wife and I got involved with American Indians, there was a great controversy in the church. Some congregations were very supportive to us. Others were very condemnatory. In fact, some were so condemnatory that they offered to cease supporting the mission of the church unless the church repudiated what we were doing. Most of those that did that were opposed, came from communities which were all white communities. So one of the things you can do is to study the issues, try to understand what some of the congregations who are dealing with directly with that concern, what they're struggling with, and be supportive to them. That's one thing you can do. The second thing I think you can do in those communities is to be sure that inclusiveness includes all the kinds of people you have in your community.
Well, we had a Negro family.
The poor, I don't mean just colored.
Well.
I don't mean just colored. I mean the poor people in your community, maybe the people who are deviants. AIDS is beginning to spread out, you know, into the rural area. We come from a rural town. We've already had a case of AIDS in that town. What's the church's responsibility to those people? You know, I'm not saying that I'm for AIDS, but I'm wondering, what is our mission in the midst of that? We're in an era now where we're struggling with gays and lesbians, and whether they fit somewhere in the mission of the church. Well, women, young people,
single parents.
Okay. All right. So I don't think that we have to construe this inclusiveness only to mean people of color. It has to begin to help us reach out with the gospel in all segments of life, whether we like it or not.
I'd like to raise a question. When you're speaking of, for example, just as an example, the Indian population, what plans does the church have to recognize their religion and incorporate it into ours? Because it seems in the past our missionaries have gone into that we are the right,
yeah.
You are wrong.
Yeah.
What are we doing on that at the Matthew?
Well, I can't give you specifics at this point because the new church hasn't started yet, and its mission is now being shaped, so that will emerge. But I can tell you that in my segment of the new church, the ALC, the present ALC, that in the last number of years, the World Mission Department has begun to incorporate that kind of thing into its training of missionaries, so that missionaries tend to go out now with a somewhat different attitude than what you're describing, rather than that somewhat arrogant theological attitude that we've always had. I think this conference in Denver that I went to a couple weeks ago was a significant step, because if we're going to begin to do that theologically, to listen to Indians, you see, and then maybe take steps beyond that, to listen to liberation theology, to listen to some black people as they try to speak out of their experience, maybe the new church will be able to be more open theologically. I can't really answer your question, what we're doing, because it's not yet answered. I mean, the answers aren't there yet.
I thought that Jack McLean's presence the last week has been a wonderful illustration of inclusivity.
Yeah.
My 18-year-old son and I were chalet mates with Jack, and my son hasn't had a lot of contact with people of color. And it was just very interesting to me for us to get to know Jack, to hear his very real gifts. I even had a lesson from him on chanting, which I know will be very helpful to me. And just his presence here,
yes.
And sharing that housing facility,
yeah.
I thought was just very potent and a very real part of what Holden means to me at this moment.
Fortunately, Jack is a very strong person. I mean, he's gentle, but he's strong. He knows who he is. He has great gifts and talents. I was just moved by his music. And his presence, the way he conducted matins and so on, or vespers, I mean, and so on, it was really tremendous. I don't think we can expect most people of color to come with those kinds of gifts. And the presence of Jack here was a tremendous experience for all of us here. But I think if we're going to really reach out and include people, it's going to be at a different level than that, because not all blacks are that attractive and that talented.
Pardon?
Or whites, right. I'm sorry, I shouldn't.
But we don't think that.
I've got to look at the green sheet again.
Yeah, this lady's comment about the Asian doctor, you know, all of a sudden, that's what that Asian means to us.
Yeah.
If a white person did the same thing, you'd recognize that individual was
We'd be a little upset with that, too.
Yeah, you'd be upset with that individual, but...
I don't like Florida.
Yeah.
It makes me all complete.
But I think that's a real danger, because it's a prejudice in another way, too, if you're solicitous.
No.
Well, he's black, yeah.
We have the black family. He was at the service. He was in town. He came to our church, or he didn't. His wife and children did. And as far as I know, there was no problem. Everybody felt very comfortable with him.
One black in a community is almost always welcome, because they're no threat to anybody. It's when you begin to get quite a few of them that we whites begin to back off and wonder whether they're going to begin to muscle in on some things that we are, that are dear, you know, near and dear to us.
And we've had a Mexican family that lived there for years, have moved away, but everybody in town speaks very highly of them. Yeah. So it isn't that we haven't had any contact.
That's great. I wasn't criticizing you. I graduated from St. Olaf in 1937, and I had a black classmate who went all the way through. He grew up in Waseca, Minnesota, which is quite a good Scandinavian town, and he spoke Norwegian. We called him the sunburnt Norwegian. And you can imagine, he was quite acceptable at St. Olaf. He really fit right in.
I think he was probably accepted in the community, because I
yes.
here and there, and they were
yeah.
on the basketball.
The only trouble what happened to this guy is, when he left St. Olaf and Waseca, he went to New York to go to the Columbia School of Social Work. And wow, all of a sudden he realized he was black. This was back in the 1930s. And from being in this nice, warm, accepting Scandinavian college with nice, warm, accepting people and so on, he suddenly got out there and he was a nigger, you know. And it took him years to get over that.
I'll bet he also couldn't marry a nice, warm, accepting Scandinavian woman either.
Pardon?
I'll bet in those years he also could not marry a lovely co-ed from St. Olaf.
Yeah, that's right. That didn't happen.
Who could he date?
But I think that illustrates some of the complexity of the problem that we deal with in being inclusive. Yeah.
I have one more comment. We as whites have an obnoxious characteristic in many respects, as looking at the black population illustration. Some years ago, we lived in a community in Minnesota called Wilmer, which you
yes.
probably know.
Yeah.
At that time, there was a big move on to integrate the junior college, and they brought in black people, and there were some fine black people. But we had some whites that you can't really have a proper description of, who proceeded to create trouble with and upset the whole Wilmer community. So we as whites have got to learn, we've got to educate those people, that's all there is.
Yeah, one of the points I made was self-examination. I think you're dead right on that. We're going to have the same thing happen in the church. As the church begins to get inclusive, we're going to have those people who are going to make trouble. And they'll have good rational reasons for making trouble. We will have to be on the guard on that. Well, it's already almost 20 after, and we should have a few minutes before Vespers. Anybody else have a burden on their heart that they want to unload? Well, thank you for your participation, and as I said, I look forward with great eagerness to the new church. It's going to be a real adventure. Thank you.